Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast with Bhairav Patel and Alan Clark.
Welcome to the Real World Entrepreneurship Podcast, where we tackle the practical challenges that startup founders and small business owners face and give our own unvarnished opinions. My name is Bhairav Patel. I'm the Managing Director at Atom Ventures and Atom CTO, where we partner with small businesses and startup founders to help them define and build their tech vision.
And I'm Alan Clark. I'm the founder of the Business Growth Partnership, and we work with high-potential businesses to help them unblock the blockages that are preventing them from reaching their full potential.
Welcome, everybody. We're here today with Robert Flint from Advisely. Robert is a lawyer turned entrepreneur, and we're going to be discussing what entrepreneurs need to know about the law, but also his transformation from lawyer to entrepreneur and how he sees the world differently because of it. Hi, Robert. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm a recovering lawyer, I suppose you could say. I qualified as a solicitor in London in 2013 in the corporate team. And was there for 5 years. I took a bit of a break, went to France to learn French with my other half, which was an exciting thing to do, and started a business while I was there doing legal and regulatory policy advice. And that sort of spun out of an idea that came from my previous firm, where they wanted some advice for their clients. In the sort of policy regulatory space, responding to consultations. So while doing that, I was found by Carbon Law Partners and invited to become a partner at Carbon Law Partners, which is a platform law firm in the UK where essentially you run your own practice. So I set up a corporate practice, small corporate practice, and gradually grew that over 3 years. And based on my experience, both living in France, setting up a business, and running my own practice in the UK, I, in both situations, struggled to find overseas advice for myself and my clients. So a lawyer in France or an accountant in Spain or what have you, that was always a very difficult thing to do for a small business. There's clearly a gap there. So over the course of my experience at Carbon, I was gradually sort of thinking about this idea and took the leap at the beginning of this year. So the 1st of January was my first day full time on this. And it's been really fun. And starting a business during a lockdown and a massive recession might seem like a terrible idea, but I think it's an excellent idea and a great way of enjoying yourself while you can't do anything else. So there we go. That's me.
So you're an entrepreneurial lawyer. Is that not just a complete contradiction?
So there are a lot more entrepreneurial lawyers than lawyers are often given credit for. And that indeed is what they're the people I'm trying to find with Advisely. Because I know they're out there and I know that most lawyers aren't like that. So it's a case of finding them and bringing them together. The best lawyers take the position from their client and then figure out how to do it within the law, to do what the client wants within the law. Rather than saying, you know, this is the law, you can't do X, you can't do Y, without really engaging with the problem. Most lawyers try to do that. Most lawyers pay lip service at the very least to that. But the really good ones sort of live and breathe it. And the difficult balance for a lawyer, and it is tricky, the reason why it appears a contradiction in terms is because lawyers are on the hook if things go wrong. So either they are, obviously they could be sued by their clients if things go wrong, or they could be hauled up in front of the regulator if things go wrong. So we're held to a very high standard, and that makes us risk averse as a bunch.
So as you are sitting now starting up your business, what are those key principles you took from your legal career that you have taken into your entrepreneurial life as great learnings that only legal people really know?
That's a really good question. I suppose in terms of stuff that other people might do to do well as well, it's always important to just be incredibly honest and open and frank with the people you're doing business with, because most disputes will arise because of a misunderstanding and not because anyone is trying to get the better of you. So if you have those discussions early, whether it's with founders or business partners, contractors, what have you, then you're much less likely to come into dispute territory. So I suppose that's number one. The second one is to write things down. Lawyers come into the process normally at the stage when things are being written down. But there's rarely an instance where it would, it would have been worse to have written them down earlier. And that doesn't mean that you need to have a fully fledged contract, with all the bells and whistles. But just like with my first point about having the discussion, if you've written it down, it's much less easy to misunderstand what has actually been agreed. And that's ultimately the point of the contract.
I think that's a brilliant, brilliant observation. Because one of the challenges I've so often had is, this is the third time you've talked about this point, and every time you've said something different. But the act of actually putting it down in black and white forces one to make a commitment to what is actually on that document. Because that document exists long after the words have come out of my mouth.
Yeah, exactly. So in another life, I was also a special constable, and we were trained that, I think there was a criminal barrister in a case who said that if you didn't write it down, it didn't happen, which is to say to the police that, when you're in that situation, write down everything that you see and hear and do. Otherwise, there's no evidence that it happened and it will be questioned later on. And it's exactly the same in relation to commercial agreement, commercial terms. So absolutely, write it down and don't be shy about having the conversations, writing it down, and make it a process of finding out what each other wants rather than a process of saying, I don't trust you, which is always the implication, which is why people don't do it. But if it's a process of let's find out what we want and make sure we actually agree, then that's a more positive conversation.
I guess that highlights the point as well, that the point of a contract is not so you can wave at each other in a court of law. It's so you've actually written it down so you never end up in the court of law because we've actually agreed what we're going to say.
Yeah,
and at a level, we don't need a contract and we've written it down nice and clearly and everybody agrees on exactly what we're doing and then we just do it.
Yeah. So the difficulty arises, the reason why law is then useful, it's useful for lots of reasons, but in terms of avoiding conflicts is because lawyers themselves will have experienced lots of different problems with other clients and lots of different legal issues that arise commonly. So they will be alive to the issues that you might not spot. So that's a reason to get lawyers involved. That can solve a lot of problems in the long term. But in terms of and this is the thing I'm learning as a startup founder, you take each problem as it arises. There's only so much foresight you can have when you don't even know whether your idea is going to make any money. So why would you spend huge amounts on, a shareholders agreement when you have no idea whether a customer is going to buy your product?
So it's an impossible question, I suspect. But as a startup founder, as I lie in bed for the 55th night awake, contemplating every angle on it, and eventually I make my commitment, I am going to do this, how soon should I speak to a lawyer after that point?
Well, this is the million-dollar question. And as a lawyer who is not experienced at doing software development or marketing or anything like that, I have the same question, but in relation to those things. So when should I stop faffing around with WordPress and get someone else to do it for me? When is the right time to instruct outside counsel in relation to anything? It's really hard because essentially the answer is obviously, and it's not a helpful answer really, but as early as possible, in the context of when you are capable of doing it. So when you have enough money, when you're confident the business is going to take off. But certainly there is no excuse really for not having the conversations and writing down, you know, a memo, heads of terms or whatever with your business partners. That's like, you have to do that. Right at the start. And there's a great book actually called Founders Dilemmas. It's quite long, but it's, it talks about basically aligning the interests of the founders, and making sure that you're on the same page. And if you're having those conversations, then, you can get it all down on paper. And then when you do come to instruct a lawyer later on, it's actually much easier because you're already aligned, and the lawyer can just be essentially, it's a point and shoot type operation. They don't need to be too creative with anything that they're doing because it's all there already. But that's a really unhelpful answer. So sorry.
Well, I am actually delighted that you did actually give me an answer, because at the beginning I was thinking, this guy is an absolute consummate lawyer. I've asked him a question, he's not answered it, but he's turned it back on me.
Yeah, well, I mean, but that is ultimately, that's inevitable, right? Because, and this is the other thing, I think, there is a tension between founders instructing lawyers and founders instructing developers or whoever. But if I were to go to a developer and say, when is the right time to get you to build my app? Or what, are you ready? Do you have enough money? Is it the right app?
You know, honestly, I thought your answer was perfect. Because it is exactly, as a marketing guy, if somebody says, well, when's the right time to do it professionally? And you nailed it with your answer, which is as soon as you can reasonably afford it, on the expectation that the risk of not doing it is greater than the expense of doing it.
Yeah.
What I took from your answer, but that I hadn't actually ever put it in those, thought of it in those terms, but I have now, and I will use that regularly going forward.
Great. Pleased to be of use.
So one of the things I've got a question is, now that you are an entrepreneur, do you look at risk differently? So when you're a lawyer and you're looking at risk for someone else, you'll think of it in one way. But then from your own perspective, now looking outwards in many ways, I guess. How do you see this?
Yeah, you take a lot more risks with your own thing than you do with anyone else's, which I guess could be infuriating if you're a client, because you want the lawyer to take a similar approach they would for themselves, I suppose, because you know you want your approach or the way you do business to be very similar, and so an entrepreneur doing business with an entrepreneur is sort of easier. But if, like I say, if you're a lawyer, the sort of the buck does stop with you. So you're slightly more, you're going to be more risk averse. And I suppose as a so I was, you know, at Carbon, it's full of entrepreneurial lawyers, right? And we all run our own practices. We go out and get our own clients. So it wasn't that I was in a firm that was, you know, stifling and all of that sort of thing. And, you know, I guess what you just do not know as a lawyer, even in the most entrepreneurial practice, is the what it's like to set up a business and have no idea whether you can have any clients at the end of the day. Because as a lawyer, you know, people need legal services. You don't need to test that principle. When you're setting something up completely from scratch, you sort of, the biggest question is, am I going to have any customers? Are they going to pay me money? Is there a problem actually that I've identified that anyone wants to solve? And are there enough people who are willing to pay me to solve it for them? And that's the priority. So as a lawyer, you're thinking, okay, well, I need to get the data protection registration. I need to have a privacy notice. I need to X, Y, and Z, get all of that sorted out. And actually, that's the stuff that, I mean, I have done that stuff because I'm a lawyer. But if you're not a lawyer, I don't think you probably do that straight away. Because you think, okay, what are the chances of the ICO actually coming down on me like a ton of bricks? Really small. What are the chances of HMRC coming down on me like a ton of brick? Really small. And what's the point in me spending all my time being procedurally excellent only to still not have a business at the end of the day? So you build a business, then you retrofit the compliance, I suppose. And that isn't, you know, if you're, it's not the best thing to do. A lawyer or an accountant can never, ever recommend that course of action because it's not the right thing to do. But it is what you sort of have to do. And I think actually that doesn't speak to lawyers and accountants being bad. That speaks to the laws themselves being bad. And I think actually the UK is one of the best places for small businesses. And it's great for the fintech sandbox. They've got law tech sandbox now as well. They are increasingly aware that lots of the regulations that are designed to protect people actually stifle business. But even in the UK, there's still a whole load of regulation and extra rules that you have to comply with, which you shouldn't really have to. I don't think, but anyway, that's a political question.
So now that you're in that entrepreneurial mindset, what would you prioritize as the top things that a startup founder should have in place? I mean, we've talked about shareholders agreements and making sure that you've got an agreement with your co-founder or whatever it is. But now that you're actually in it, are there other things that you would prioritize that you wouldn't necessarily have thought to prioritize as a lawyer? So for example, you mentioned things like making sure you've got your terms and conditions, privacy policy in place, know where your data's at, et cetera, et cetera. But that isn't really relevant until you have data, right? So there are other things that you want to protect as a ideas person now.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're talking about IP. I mean, from the data point of view, just obviously an email address from a business email counts as personal data. So this is one example of where the regulations are a bit dim, because that's absurd that you're literally triggering the legislation at that point, and the chances of anyone coming after you for that are nil. But that doesn't change. I mean, the black letter of it is that that's wrong, and it shouldn't be. So there should be some proportionality element to it. But yes, in terms of getting that right from the start, from my business point, that was business critical, because you can't go to lawyers and accountants wanting to be credible without being credible on the data point right from the start. So that was business critical for me. And it is business critical actually for a lot of tech businesses where they're going to be dealing with data, and the people, their clients and their customers are going to be very protective of the data. So you've got to get that right from the start. In terms of protecting IP, which is the other big one, really, there are two issues, really. One is knowing where your IP is. So do you own it as a person, or does your company own it? That's something you really need to get sorted out before you go to get funding or any major contracts where you might get sued or what have you. So you've just got that tidied up in the background. But the other issue is obviously the registration and the protection of your IP rights. Do you need to trademark and that sort of thing? And I think there's another thing that you don't really think of as a lawyer. So as a lawyer, you're thinking, right, okay, client comes to me, they want to, they've got this idea, needs protecting, let's protect it. Whereas actually, as a startup founder, the reason why you've had an idea that no one has quite had before, and that's either because you've seen something that no one else has, or the much more likely answer to the question is that it's a terrible idea. And so why register an idea that's terrible? Why register a name that is also probably terrible? Or, you know, you might change in a few years anyway, even if it's not a bad name. Like TransferWise, for example, obviously just changed its name and it was, I thought, quite a good name. You can, again, you can go into all this sorts of stuff about protecting your trademark and your design and it being a bit excessive. And then it's a sort of the more confident you get that your IP, your ideas are worth protecting, then you sort of delve more deeply into that arena. And the IPO does make it quite easy in this country to register IP. So I think that's, has that answered your question? What was your question?
And like so many things, this is a sort of value judgment. There isn't a right or a wrong time. There is just the time that is better or worse for your particular business.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think you have kind of answered my question. I guess what I'm trying to get at is that, yes, data protection is important. IP is important, but actually really when you started off, okay, for your business, you needed to ensure that you had the right data protection measures in place. But then apart from that, what else did you know that you needed to have in place from day one? Because you're a solo entrepreneur, right? Solopreneur, right? You don't have anyone else. So if there's another solopreneur out there, what other key things did you have in place from a legal mindset, a legal perspective when you started out? Did you have any?
Well, that's the thing. No, nothing really. That's the other thing. Like you can wait quite a long time. So the initial offer with Advisely is a free offer. There's no commission. There's no payment. So it's just people come to me. I introduce them to other lawyers and accountants. There's no contract there. I don't have a bank account yet. Not sure they should admit that, but it's still very early days. You do things as late as possible, I suppose. Well, not, you do things as late as possible, as early as you need to. Why waste time? Like saying before, why waste time setting up a bank account when I don't know that anyone's going to pay me any money?
Which is the approach that we take to technology, right? So if you can do it on a piece of paper, do it on a piece of paper. Build it when you have suddenly then thousands and thousands of people and, you know, you can't control the pieces of paper. You have
the lean startup approach, potentially, the Eric Ries of the world. I think that's right. And I think there's a whole load of problems that come before solving the legal problem. The legal contracts I have entered into are the contracts for the domain name, with who was it, A2 hosting, and then SiteGround, and there isn't even a WordPress thing, is there? That's it in terms of contracts. And I didn't even read those terms and conditions, which again I probably shouldn't admit. Lawyers never read terms and conditions when they're entering into them on their own behalf.
Are you sure this guy really is a lawyer?
So there's one question I really have to ask you, because I get you on record here. But now that you are an entrepreneur and you've dealt with startups and you know many, many lawyers that are dealing with startups, do you feel that it's value for money when you're a startup and you're getting charged? I know some people get charged 10 grand for some shareholders agreements. Do you feel now you're an entrepreneur that what you're getting is value for money?
I think the answer to that is no. But again, I would absolve the lawyers and the accountants from blame in most cases. So most lawyers and accountants are not out to screw over their clients, and the price that they will quote will be the price that they that is reasonable for them, and is the what they believe is the market standard, and is the price they think they can do it at. So then the question is, why does it cost so much for them to do it? So this comes down to what the hourly rate is in a law firm. So if you're putting a price on a shareholders agreement, say, you think, how long is this going to take? What's my hourly rate, which is set by somebody else? Multiply the two together and you get the roughly what the thing is going to be. And then you're like, well, actually, realistically, it's going to take longer than that because there's always extra conversations and bits and bobs and formatting and stuff that a lawyer shouldn't really be doing, but always ends up doing. And so prices are sort of based on that model.
Going back to your earlier point, that actually, if we had me and my startup partners and actually downloaded a standard off-the-shelf shareholders agreement, read through it, captured the key points that are relevant to us on a piece of paper, identified anything unusual, and said to our lawyer, look, we've done the legwork ourselves, we just need your help to capture this agreement in a contractually upstanding document,
yeah,
we can get it done a heck of a lot cheaper.
Yes, although not all lawyers would do that. So the problem is, in that situation, what you're essentially doing as a client conceptually is saying, right, we don't really want to pay you, but if things go wrong, we want to be able to claim under your insurance.
No, that's not what I mean at all. What I mean is, instead of going in and saying, I have no idea what a shareholders agreement even looks like, I have no idea what our point of view is on any point within it, we haven't even thought about this, we want you to teach us all about it and walk us through every single aspect. That, frankly, in my experience, a lot of it is pretty standard. And a lot of it you can actually say, how are we running this business? What is our agreement? And then there's only two or three little challenging parts that actually need real advice on, somebody to help us form a solution.
Yeah, so I think what tends to happen is you start with a precedent, and it, conceptually it should be, like you say, essentially building blocks that you've got the various bits of the agreement, you know, the governance clause, jurisdiction clause, all fairly standard. A lot of it should be able to be dragged through from a Excel spreadsheet potentially, and the tech exists to do that. So you could churn out a shareholders agreement that will do sort of 90% of what you want it to do, and it's that extra 10. It's the extra 10% that then is trickier, because inevitably the clients will say, oh, but, you know, actually, so the circumstances aren't quite, you know, it doesn't fit precedent. And then that, for whatever reason, means that the whole agreement then has to change. And that is a frequent occurrence. And you sort of, the clients are really simple, really, really basic, you know, nothing complicated. And then you ask them some questions and they come back and say, well, actually, no, that sounds great. I'll have that, and I'll have that, and I'll have that. And then sort of the Christmas tree grows and grows and grows until it's, you know, covered in baubles and is, you know, fancier than it needs to be potentially. But to going back to the point about I started with, about the fact that it's not really lawyers and accountants' fault. So two things. It's the system. So the hourly rate pricing and the fact that the lawyers involved don't really have a say in what their rate is. So if they want to offer a cheaper price, they have to say they're going to do it much faster. And then what that means for them on a practical level is that if they're saying this shareholder agreement will take 2 hours and it actually takes 4 hours, then they either have to bill the client for double what they estimated, or they have to say that they only bill half the amount of time that they've spent, which gets them in trouble with their superiors or means that they're not billing as much. So it hurts all of their incentives, their bonuses, their, you know, whatever structure you're doing. It makes them look like they're not working hard if they don't record the hours at all. So all of that is problematic for how the certain firms work. That's point one, if I can be allowed to have all of that in one point. And the second point is that technology is increasingly able to take away huge amounts of the grunt work on this. And technology will mean that most of the simple things that startups and other small businesses need to do will be able to be done by technology. And the lawyers and the accountants should be more sort of strategic risk advisors, where they know what to look out for. And the documents should be much more not standardized, because I think this is the problem. I think there's no such thing as a normal business, and there's no such thing as a normal relationship between founders or anything like that. So there will always be bespoke bits that need to be added, but bespoke bits should be able to be factored into the mechanics of how you write an agreement. So all of those in the future, I think, will be, I mean, essentially you'd get a suite of documents, and you can already do this with a sort of slightly more, it's not basic, they're quite involved, quite clever things that they can do now. But you could get it to almost the point where you can do everything. And then you have a lawyer check it, and then it's a question of how much they charge for that total service. Who's going to, what the competition then looks like.
So then I guess we're winding up now, right? But I think in the closing notes, what would you say if someone's coming to start up a business now, right? And maybe they're joining you on your accelerator. What would be your immediate tips? What would be the top five things that you'd say? Here's a summary of what you should make sure you know and have in place, or you think about.
In terms of what legal
in legal documents, yeah.
If there is more than one of you, an agreement between founders, number one, align your interests, make sure that you actually should be co-founding the business together. Number two, once you've done that, obviously you're going to need to incorporate the company. In 9.5 times out of 10, it's going to be a limited private company limited by shares. So the basic offer on Companies House, it's really easy to do. You don't need a lawyer to do it. You'll get the model articles, which is another document that will be a standard document that will be given to you by the government. Have a read of those to make sure that you're happy with how the business mechanics work. So at board meetings, who votes, and does the chairman have a casting vote, that sort of thing, who the chairman is. You're going to need to figure out how many shares each of you own in that company. And that obviously ties in with the original discussion you had about the shareholders agreement and where you're going to be in a year's time or 2 years' time. Because when you're starting something up like this, you don't know if you're going to get another job. If you get a great job offer, do you take that? And then what happens to that person's shares in the business? That's a real worry. Or if the person turns out to be pretty rubbish, and you just don't know, then again, what happens? Is there a mechanism for getting rid of them? If they agree in advance to what that mechanism is in the original sort of agreement, that's much better way of doing it. So, that's shareholders agreement and, articles. It depends on the shape of the business, but if you're having clients straight away, and customers straight away, then obviously you're going to need a contract with those customers and those clients. And depending on the length of the relationship with those clients, will determine how important those contracts are. So if you're going to have one big enterprise client for the first year of your existence, that contract needs to be really good. So get a lawyer to do that. If it's, terms and conditions that are going to apply to everyone, you can probably use a precedent you can find somewhere and tweak it to your circumstances. So, X will deliver Y at this time to this standard, et cetera. If there's an international element, obviously that's more complicated. What else? Data protection, privacy policy, obviously. These are fairly standard. The most important thing about data protection, though, the privacy policy is basically tells the client what you do with their data. So the most important thing really, while, getting consents and all that sort of stuff is important, is actually making sure you abide by your own privacy policy and don't mess around with other people's data. So, the policy is a good framework to base your own behavior on. How many is that? Is that four?
Yeah.
But, an IP transfer agreement, I suppose. So again, if you've got founders, and one person is doing all of the marketing, another is doing is the CEO and doing the business type stuff for it, and then the other is the CTO or the software developer, then potentially, depending on when everything started, all of the IP potentially is owned by the individual, or at least there's going to be doubt as to who owns the IP. So, which is no good at all if you've got two founders who are scurrying away, doing lots of work on the business, and it turns out they fall out, and the developer CTO says, "Oh, actually, no, I own all of this," and then it's on the other two founders to then go and get the IP, essentially, to try and prove that they have some ownership to it. And if the software developer has all the passwords, then that's actually quite difficult to do. And it becomes a question not of what is legally right, but who holds who's left holding the keys to the kingdom. And it's harder to go and get the keys to the kingdom than it is to have them all, distributed right at the start.
Hmm. Robert, can I just thank you so much for coming on the podcast? That is about, honestly, one of the most interesting podcasts that I've been involved in. I've learned so much about... from your perspective about how a lawyer looks at these things, but also how an entrepreneur looks at it as well. Thank you so much for joining us. And presumably you're not that far removed from a lawyer that we shouldn't expect a bill for your time shortly.
No bills. Like I said, don't have a bank account, so I wouldn't have anywhere for you to send me any money.
Robert, if people want to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
So it's rflint@advisely.io or www.advisely.io. There's a couple of forms on there you can fill in. But if you want any introductions to any lawyers or accountants around the world, let me know. Any price for the fees, and I won't charge you anything. So that's what I'm doing.
Excellent.
Brilliant. 90 million.
Many thanks for taking the time to listen to the podcast today. If you like what you hear, please leave a review or subscribe. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, all the main podcasting sites. And if you'd like to learn more from us, you can contact Alan. He's alan@tbgp.co.uk. And you can find me at info@atomcto.com.